You can hear American Roots every Saturday from noon until 2 right here on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, at 89.9 in Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Check out our playlist, podcast, and more at KAXE.org. It is 2 o'clock. I'm Malachi Coons. In just a moment, we'll be bringing you Shiro's Radio. Then at 3 p.m., a re-airing of our mixtape from Monday, celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day with host DJ Siege and DJ Dang. After that, Eric Otto hosting our Americana show from 5 to 7. Check out a complete schedule of all of our programs and hosts at KAXE.org. Here's Shiro's Radio.
Support for The Road to Joanie, A Shiro's Journey, is powered by Rivian, makers of the all-electric R1S three-row SUV and R1T pickup truck. Learn more or schedule a demo drive in your area at Rivian.com. Hey, I'm Carmel Holt, and welcome to The Road to Joanie, A Shiro's Journey. In this special 10-episode series, we are celebrating the legacy and renaissance of the most influential and singular of Shiros, Joanie Mitchell, one of the most impactful artists across genres, genders, and generations. We'll travel together through Joanie's 6-decade catalog, hear some of our favorite artists talk about their roads to Joanie and where those roads led them, all while I take Shiro's on the road from New York State to Los Angeles with a destination of Joanie Mitchell's return to the stage at the Hollywood Bowl. We are living in the time of Joanie Mitchell, and all of us are on this road together. As I record this, I'm in Joanie Mitchell's adopted hometown of Los Angeles and just days away from Joanie's 2 nights at the Hollywood Bowl. I am super excited. And 2 nights before her shows, there's a huge tribute here in Los Angeles to Joanie's late friend, Robbie Robertson, and the Last Waltz called Life is a Carnival. Previous Road to Joanie guest Don Was will be playing, as well as one of this week's guests, Bruce Hornsby, who not only recorded with Robbie Robertson, but also worked with Don Was on Bonnie Raitt's album, Luck of the Draw. Like Don and Bonnie, Bruce is a huge Joanie fan. And while he didn't work with Joanie, he's worked with many of her favorite collaborators. More on that in just a moment. Last time on The Road to Joanie, Aruj Aftab curated an amazing playlist for us of some of her favorite deeper Joanie Mitchell cuts. One of the songs that we talked about was from the 1982 album Wild Things Run Fast called Be Cool. And Aruj pointed out the killer bass line that the song begins with. Wild Things Run Fast was Joanie's first album to work with bassist Larry Klein. She and Larry married in 1982, and he played bass and co-produced her next 4 albums, 1985's Dog Eat Dog, 1988's Chalk Mark and Rainstorm, 1991's Night Ride Home, and Joanie's Grammy-winning 15th studio album, Turbulent Indigo, in 1994, which was also the year of their separation.
Turbulent Indigo, when you were going into the studio, not a secret, you were separating from your husband, who ended up becoming the co-producer on the album. Mm-hmm. What's that like?
It was very strange at first. So what we did to lighten it up was, I love cats, and my husband, Klein, had come to love them too, but in separating, I had the cats. So we went out to buy him a cat, and we came back with 2 toms, and we let them loose in the studio, and that was a wonderful solution. It created a lot of levity and diversion. You know, in the beginning of a relationship, how it's so synchronistic, and,
oh, yeah.
And it seems like you're thinking and clicking at the same moment, and it's so close-making. Well, at the end, you withhold that. You kind of slam that door shut and demand explanation. You're not being as clear as you think you are. That kind of stuff. So that was going back and forth from both of us. And it got pretty funny, and we transcended that. And I think we made a really good album.
Just ice, coming by and reading love. and I met when I was 25, and she was 13 years older than me, and, you know, we met in the context of working on a record. I got called to play bass on this record, and, you know, over the course of a year, our relationship evolved from being a working one and a friendship to a romantic relationship and eventually to being married. But, you know, from the beginning, and the thing that always was at the center of our relationship was that we had this kinetic and fantastic ongoing discussion of the aesthetics of everything. And, you know, I mean, we could sit and talk for 5 hours about a book. And in the process of that, on my end, it goes without saying that she's a pretty brilliant person, you know, in almost every respect. And so it was an education for me in many ways, you know, and an education in action where we were kind of teaching each other and finding fresh ground within things that we knew and arguing and debating. And so, you know, whenever I'm asked, what did you derive from the relationship in a sense of what you make and how you think about music and how you think about the arts, you know, it's a universe in itself, what I learned from her.
That's bassist and producer Larry Klein, an excerpt of an interview with Jake Feinberg. We also heard Joni talking with CBS in 1995 on making Turbulent Indigo with Larry Klein, plus a clip of Sex Kills from that Grammy-winning album. Their parting was amicable, and in 2000, Larry Klein and Joni Mitchell reunited as co-producers of her Grammy-winning orchestral album, Both Sides Now. They also collaborated on Mitchell's 2002 album, Travelogue, and Larry Klein was at the production helm of Herbie Hancock's Grammy-winning 2007 tribute to Joni Mitchell called River, The Joni Letters, which we touched on last episode when Brittany Howard took the vocals on Both Sides Now with Herbie Hancock at the Kennedy Center Honors. During their time together, Larry Klein became an in-demand producer, including a couple of Sean Colvin's early records, 1992's Fat City, which, if you look up the studio on Wikipedia, it says it was recorded at, quote, Larry Klein's house, which was, of course, Joni's house. For both of today's guests, it was through working with Larry Klein on those Sean Colvin records that the road to Joni led to her door. Singer, pianist, composer, and bandleader Bruce Hornsby was born in Williamsburg, Virginia in 1954. That was the year after a 9-year-old Joan Anderson was living through the wave of polio infections that swept across Canada. Here's Joni Mitchell.
I got polio at the age of 9. T3, that was the last year of it before the Salk vaccine.
I mean, you tell this story of actually getting up in the morning and looking into a mirror and knowing that something was different.
Yeah, I got up and all I remember was my first thought was, because I said to myself, you look like a woman today, which means something had altered in my face. Either I had dark circles or my face was slightly swollen. Something looked different. I dressed myself. I walked to school with a chum. The third block before the school, I had to sit down and take a little rest because I was aching. And I said, oh dear, I'm getting old. I must have rheumatism, because my grandmother had rheumatism. The following day, I couldn't get out of bed. I was paralyzed. When they diagnosed it, they shipped me up to a polio colony outside St. Paul's Hospital in Saskatoon.
And they were like leper colonies, weren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, they were annexed trailers, and they were kind of terrifying. The sound, not so much in the daytime because the halls were full of activity, but at night, the sound of the iron lungs, that wheezing breathing, it was a terrible sound, and we all dreaded the possibility that we could end up in one of those cans.
Is that what you thought, that you might never be able to walk, that you might never be able to breathe, that you're going to spend the rest of your life in this iron lung?
Well, if the disease spread into your lungs, you'd go into the iron lung because you'd have to have mechanical aid. And if you got into an iron lung, chances are you'd never get out. And there was a possibility that I would never walk. I was frozen. Many of the muscles in my back were lost. As a result, my spine was crooked and arched up like a broken doll. So anyway, Christmas was nearing, and I said to the doctors, I want to go home for Christmas. And they said, you can't. You know, I said, why not? Well, because you can't walk. Well, what if I walked? You know, they said, well, you can't stand. But what if I stood and walked? And they hung their heads as if there wasn't really a possibility. And my mother had put a little Christmas tree in the room, and that night, after lights out, they let me leave it on for an extra hour. And I said to the little tree, emphatically, I am not a cripple. No way, I'm not a cripple, you know, and I kind of made a promise to the tree or to God or to someone that if I was allowed to walk again, that I would pay it back.
Joni Mitchell on having polio as a child. As she told interviewer Pamela Wallen, her convalescence lasted just about a year. And while she was in Canada coming out of her recovery, Bruce Hornsby was coming into the world on November 23rd, 1954. Bruce graduated from high school right about the same time that I was born, in 1973, and went on to study music at University of Richmond, then two semesters at Berklee College of Music, and then graduated from the University of Miami in 1977. So each of Bruce Hornsby's college years was soundtracked by a new Joni Mitchell album. 1974, Court and Spark. 1975, Hissing of Summer Lawns. 1976, Hejira. And 1977, Don Juan's Reckless Daughter, which was also the first album to feature saxophonist and longtime collaborator Wayne Shorter, who would eventually appear on one of Bruce Hornsby's albums. His third release and final album with his band The Range, called A Night on the Town. Fire on the Cross from the 1990 Bruce Hornsby and the Range album, A Night on the Town, featuring Wayne Shorter, and our other guest today, Bela Fleck, on the banjo. Bruce Hornsby's career took off in 1986 with the release of his multi-platinum and Grammy-winning debut album, The Way It Is. But like his shero, Joni Mitchell, Bruce didn't let success box him into any one genre. He stretched into jazz, worked with the Grateful Dead for many years, played piano on albums for many Joni-adjacent artists like Bob Dylan, Bonnie Raitt, Robbie Robertson, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and evolved his sound and his catalog to include bluegrass, folk rock, classical, jam band, as well as compositions for film scores. He's a three-time Grammy winner and a 10-time nominee, and more recent collaborators include Y Music, Justin Vernon, and Joni Jam members Blake Mills and Matt Chamberlain. This is Bruce Hornsby's Road to Joni. Bruce Hornsby, welcome to The Road to Joni. Thank you so much for doing this.
It's a perfect topic for me, as you'll see.
Well, very good. I'm excited to hear. What was your road to Joni?
Yeah, the initial road is nothing special. I, like, of course, a whole lot of people, came to Joni in the Court and Spark days. Alas, probably because of the two hits, you know, Free Men of Paris helped me, probably brought me to that. It's, you know, good 50 plus years ago now. But those songs made me buy the record. And then the songs that I discovered, the album tracks, just dropped me. The title song, Love Came to My Door, da-da-da-da. Again and again, the same situation. So many years, and then into a ringing telephone. I just remember them so well. It's down to you, you know. So, all the people at these parties, they got a lot of style. You know, that was just it for me. Car on the Hill. So I was in. I was an instant fan. And then I think that Miles of Isles came out. Maybe they were real smart about it. Decided they've quadrupled their audience probably instantly. But it's a soft core audience. It's top 40 audience, which is ephemeral. You know, here today, mostly gone tomorrow, unless you continue to have those records. So they were smart. They capitalized on the moment, and they put out Miles of Isles, I think, which was a great live record. And that just drew anybody who was interested, who really delved into that record, into the catalog, the pre-Court and Spark catalog. And so I was one of those people who had just swallowed it all whole. A Case of You, a Woman of Heart and Mind, A Circle Game, All I Want, just could keep going, songs from the earlier records. So now I was a complete Joni Mitchell devotee.
You're so sweet, oh, I could drink a kiss of you, and I would still be on my feet, I would still be on my feet.
from the 1974 live album Miles of Isles, the first live album by Joni Mitchell released in 1974. This was a double album documenting her concerts in support of Court and Spark with her backing band for the tour, the LA Express. This became one of her biggest selling records. Here's Bruce Hornsby.
So then, speaking of my journey, before I got into Joni, which was probably 74, I got into the piano just a couple of years before that because of Elton John's Tumbleweed Connection record, which was his version of Ian Bernie Taupin decided to make their version of what Robbie Robertson and the band, Levon Helm and those guys were doing. That just dropped a whole lot of people in a beautiful way, and they were among that crowd.
Soon the palms will be falling everywhere. Village children fight each other for a share. And the 609 goes roaring past the creek. Deacon Lee prepares a sermon for next week. I saw Grandma yesterday down at the store. Well, she's really going fine for 84. Well, she asked me if sometime I'd fix her barn. Poor old girl, she needs a hand to run the farm.
Elton John's Country Comfort from his 1973 album, Tumbleweed Connection, a collection inspired by the band and Robbie Robertson. Many years later, Bruce featured Elton John in a duet on his 2004 album, Halcyon Days. As I mentioned earlier, Bruce Hornsby recorded with Robbie on his 1991 second solo album, Storyville, and is part of the lineup for the big tribute in Los Angeles just a couple nights prior to Joni's shows at the Hollywood Bowl. Here's Bruce.
So I got into that, all the great piano. And I was also got really into the piano because of Leon Russell and Mad Dogs and Englishman Joe Cocker and then Leon's solo record. So I was really into that. And then I'd gotten into Keith Jarrett and Bill Evans and McCoy Tyner and Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea, et cetera. Took a deep dive into the jazz language. And then I got into Joni from there. So then after Miles of Isles, Hissing of Summer Lawns was the next record, I think. And so, you know, down in the cellar in the boho zone, I went looking for sweet inspiration. Oh, well, just another hard time band. You know, it's just so great. I was, again, just totally taken with it all. Edith and the Kingpin. Again, just totally taken with it all. Edith and the Kingpin. So, love that. It was sort of jazzy sounding, I guess you could say. But then the next record was the one that really totally transformed me, Hejira, which was not really jazzy at all. There was no piano on it, for instance, not that I remember. It was really just a guitar record that seemed as if she'd written it on the road. I think maybe that's the possibly apocryphal story, but I think it also may be true. So, yeah, Amelia, it was just a false alarm. It's Coyote and, oh, man, Refuge of the Rose, Hejira. Yes, Furry Sings the Blues. Points a finger at me and says, I don't like you.
Everybody laughs as if it's the old man's standard joke. But it's true, we're only welcome for our drink and smoke.
That just crushed me. I was still at the University of Miami at the time. That's my last year, so that would have been 76, 77. So I was turning my fellow jazzers onto that, and they didn't have enough hip changes, quote unquote, you know, because it was coming from more of a, I guess, folk guitar thing. But Jaco was on the record, and his contribution was transcendent. And then the next record came out, which was sort of the beginning of the next phase where she got really even more adventurous. And so, oh yeah, I loved all that Jericho. It was one of the couple of new songs that they included on Miles of Isles. So as you see, I remember this pretty well.
It's amazing. But
the one that really dropped me and has never stopped, it's grabbed me and it's never let go, is Paprika Plains, the 16-minute long orchestral opus with Jaco and Wayne Shorter coming in later. That seemed to signal the beginning of a long Joni and Wayne Shorter collaboration that lasted for many years after that.
No matter what you do, I'm floating back, I'm floating back to
Paprika Plains from Joni Mitchell's 1977 ninth album, Don Juan's Reckless Daughter. We also heard a clip of Furry Sings the Blues from Hajira and Edith and the Kingpin from Hissing of Summer Lawns. We're on the road to Joni with Bruce Hornsby. I'm Carmel Holt.
Years later, I guess in the early 90s, after we had sort of broken as a group, I was asked to play, I'm from Virginia, with the Richmond Symphony. So I needed someone to write some orchestral charts. I knew how to do it, but I was lazy. I didn't really want to. I didn't think I'd be very good at it. Obviously, I was interested in the orchestrator and composer, the great Michael Gibbs, who had orchestrated Paprika Plains. I knew Larry Klein a bit. I played on the early Sean Colvin records, and Larry produced it. So I got to know Larry from playing sessions for him. And so Larry hooked me up with Joni. And so I had a great conversation with her because I wanted to ask her about Mike Gibbs. And so we had, a glorious conversation. For her, it was just probably another musical rap session. But she had great insight about her time with Gibbs. So that was an amazing moment for me. I just thought from Paprika Plains, I would fast forward a good 14, 15 years later because that song led to my conversation with Joni. But then backing up, I think Mingus came later, and Mingus kind of threw me, even though I was very steeped in the jazz language, but I got into it and then kept on up with Chalk Mark and a Rainstorm and While Things Run Fast. I just kept it all the way up to Shine, a record from the early to mid-aughts, 2000. And something like that. I love it. Night of the Iguanas.
The tour bus came yesterday. The driver's a mess today. It's a dump of a destiny, but it's got a new. Now the kid must see through blindness. She's moving it hard on his holy fire. Since the preacher's not dead, that drunk will have to do.
Night of the Iguana by Joni Mitchell from her 2007 album, Shine. We're with Bruce Hornsby on the road to Joni.
So yeah, I stayed with it and just loved her path because, she just never gave a rat's ass about the commercial side. It was true artistry and interested in evolving as an artist. And that's really what I've been interested in as well in my career. It's not like I took that from Joni, but I've just been a kindred spirit, I would say, in that regard. Also, I have to shout out Vince Mendoza's amazing, beautiful orchestration and her incredible singing with her more latter-day voice, smoky voice, both sides. Now, I just got chills thinking about it because it's so great. It's so, again, to use the word transcendent, another time, because that is truly that version. I always loved Both Sides Now. It was great. Didn't Get Me Like Amelia, It Was a False Alarm, or Hajira, like Paprika Plains, or some of the other ones that I mentioned. I always liked Both Sides Now, but this version, just again, I just got chills twice thinking about it.
Rose and flows of angel hair, and ice cream castles in the air,
and feather canyons everywhere. Looked at clouds that way, but now they only block the sun. They rain and they snow on everyone. So many things I would have done, but clouds got in my way. I've looked at clouds from both sides now, from up and down, and still somehow it's cloud illusions I recall. I really don't know clouds.
From the Grammy-winning 2000 album of the same name, Joni Mitchell and that gorgeous orchestrated version of Both Sides Now. And the recording won arranger Vince Mendoza a Grammy. Here's Bruce Hornsby.
So that's the arc of my Joni Mitchell life. It's a story.
So, Bruce, how has her renaissance of the last few years personally impacted you?
Well, I thought it was lovely, the Newport concert. My favorite part was when she put the guitar on and instantly transported me back into the Hijira sound. So yeah, that's fantastic. I love that she's had this sort of renaissance and renaissance of attention paid to her. That's maybe the most important thing because I feel like it's given her great joy.
Lastly, if you were to thank Joni, what would you thank her for?
Well, I would just thank her for her inspiration, her effect she had on me. Soulfully, spiritually, in every way. Okay, I wrote a song called Country Club Dance in the late 70s. It was totally a Joni-esque song, but that's little known. It's not that good, but it's fun. But if you heard it, you'd say, oh yeah, there's the young Hornsby doing his Joni Mitchell. But yeah, I would just thank her for all the late lonely nights in music school listening to those records and being so moved by them and then continually through the years.
Bruce Hornsby, thank you for joining us on the road to Joni. This has been so special. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Many thanks once again to Bruce Hornsby for joining us on The Road to Joni. Now, while they've never talked to each other about their mutual love for Joni Mitchell, friends and collaborators Bruce Hornsby and Bela Fleck both became connected to her through her husband, Larry Klein, working on Sean Colvin Records. And coming up, Bela Fleck shares with us the two times that he nearly met Joni, once through Larry Klein, and how one of the albums that Larry Klein produced for Joni would become one of the most meaningful albums to Bela and his family when The Road to Joni continues.
This is 91.7 KAXC, 90.5 KBXC. Right now, we are bringing you Shiro's Radio. We'll take you back there in just a moment. We receive support from the Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pacagama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities needed for a complete family vacation. With more information at greenheronbnb.com, loving the lake quietly. KAXC's election guide is focused on issues you care about and includes candidates for local government and contested races across northern Minnesota. Find more at KAXC.org by clicking on 2024 election guide to learn more about the candidates running to represent you. The Watermark Art Center is presenting Spooked, a story slam with your true scary tales on Wednesday, October 23rd at Keg and Cork in Bemidji. Music starts at 6 with stories at 7. Pre-register by calling the Watermark. I'm Malachi Coons. Right now, back to Shiro's Radio here on KAXC.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to The Road to Joni. I'm Carmel Holt. When I interviewed today's guests a few months ago, I didn't realize how connected these two musicians were. And as it turned out, when it comes to Joni Mitchell, they didn't know it either. The conversations were recorded back to back, and it was immediately clear to me that they were meant to stay together in one episode. As Bruce Hornsby and Bela Fleck are fellow travelers whose paths have crossed several times over their careers and have been companions for parts of the journey. Bela Fleck is a virtuosic and iconic banjo player who, like Bruce Hornsby, has pushed musical boundaries well beyond the expected sonic palettes of bluegrass and folk to fusion, jazz, classical, global music, and more. Now an 18-time Grammy-winning and 39-time nominated artist, Bela was born in New York City in 1958 and got his first banjo at age 15. After graduating high school, Bela moved to Boston and released his solo debut the year that Joni released the 1979 album Mingus. Now, 45 years later, Bela has over 25 studio albums, 15 collaborative albums, one live album, and close to 100 appearances on other artists' recordings. Now, we've already touched on his appearance on Bruce Hornsby's 1990 album, his last as Bruce Hornsby and The Range. He was on a couple of tracks, including one with Sean Colvin, who had put out her debut album, Steady On, the year before, with Bruce Hornsby guesting on it as well. A couple years later, Joni Mitchell husband, bassist, and producer Larry Klein produced John Colvin's second album, Fat City, a project that not only brought Bela and Bruce together on a record again, but also connected them more closely to their shiro, Joni Mitchell. But like Joni Mitchell, Bela Fleck has had long musical relationships, and one in particular that connects them in the jazz family tree is pianist Chick Corea, who worked with one of Joni's jazz heroes, Miles Davis, as well as longtime Joni collaborator and friend Herbie Hancock and Brian Blade. Bela credits Chick Corea as a major influence, and they worked together many times over the years. Chick guested on two Flecktones recordings, and in 2006, Chick Corea and Bela Fleck became duo partners and released the album The Enchantment. Now, this was the same year that Joni Mitchell released Shine and Herbie Hancock released The Joni Letters, which won Album of the Year and Best Contemporary Jazz Album at the Grammys in 2008, while Bela Fleck and Chick Corea's debut as a duo won them a Latin Grammy that same year. Fast forward 7 years and many sold-out international tours later, Bela Fleck and Chick Corea released the double live album, Two, in July 2015, just months after Joni suffered a brain aneurysm in March of that year. For those not familiar with the story, in March 2015, Joni was found unconscious in her home in Los Angeles, and it was discovered that she had suffered a brain aneurysm. Here's Joni describing the event to CBS reporter Anthony Mason at Newport 2022, where we all witnessed her miraculous return to the stage.
In her first trip back in 53 years, Joni played guitar, a skill the aneurysm took from her till only recently.
You taught yourself to play again?
I'm learning. I'm looking at videos that are on the net to see where I put my fingers, you know. And it's amazing, like, what an aneurysm knocks out. How to get out of a chair, you don't know. How to get out of a bed, you don't know how.
Yeah.
You know, you have to learn all these things by rote again, you know. I was into water ballet as a kid, and I forgot how to do the breaststroke. Every time I tried it, I just about drowned, you know. Yeah. So there's a lot of, you going back to infancy almost, you have to relearn everything.
How do you find the will to do that?
I don't know, but the surgeon that did the brain surgery on me said I had will and grit.
Yeah,
do you
think you have will and grit?
Yeah, I think I do.
She definitely does.
I've recovered from a lot of things, you know.
You sure have.
Polio.
At age 9, polio left her paralyzed. Joni willed herself to walk again.
Your friends call you a miracle.
That's Joni Mitchell in a 2022 interview with Anthony Mason of CBS at Newport Folk Festival. Now, nearly a year after Bela Fleck and Chick Corea's album came out in August of 2016, Joni's first public appearance post-aneurysm was at a Chick Corea concert in Los Angeles. And the photo that surfaced was Joni with Chick and Herbie Hancock. Chick Corea sadly passed away from cancer in 2021. And this year, Bela Fleck released their final collaborative album called Remembrance. Album Remembrance, that's Juno from Chick Corea and Bela Fleck, a song that Bela wrote for his son. And as we'll find out from Bela, his son already has a deep connection to Joni Mitchell as well. This is Bela Fleck's Road to Joni.
Bela Fleck, welcome to the Road to Joni. I'm so excited to have you here.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm a Joni fan.
I love to hear it. Let's talk about it. What was your Road to Joni?
In high school, I believe, my stepfather gave me Blue as a birthday present because my birthday's in July. You know, very scholarly fellow. He said, this is a very highly rated record and I think you'll enjoy it. So that year, my mom and my brothers and I went out to East Hampton to spend the summer. We brought that record and a record player. And for July, we played side A. And then in August, we flipped it over and played side B. And it was in repeat. It was the only record on for the whole summer. And I just fell in love with it. And I keep coming back to it over and over and over again. And it just opened the doorway to Joni for me. It was before I started playing banjo. So I wasn't a banjo person yet. But I remember that little house and that moment and just listening to that record over and over again. And then that record has come in handy, you know, over and over in life. You know, sometimes when tough things are going on, like when one of our kids was very sick and we were in the hospital with them for several weeks, we played that over and over again. And the other one I love so much is Night Ride Home. That one, you know, after many years of kind of wishing for some of the early Joni energy to come back around, although I loved everything she did, certain things became part of my life and indistinguishable from, you know, food and water and sunlight. Other records were interesting, but that one at Court and Spark, I love so many things she did all along the way. And then just who she was and the way she presented and what she was about has been an inspiration the whole way. And I think she's one of my primary fundamental influences of a great musician that just reaches me deeply over and over again.
Wow. Can you point to a song maybe from that summer? Is there a song that stands out in your memory that if you heard it would be a triggered memory from that time? Or if you want to talk about the time when your kid was in the hospital and you were leaning on it, is there a song that stands out to you from the Blue album?
Yeah, well, for Blue, gosh, the whole record is so fabulous. But my favorite one, especially for August, would be The Last Time I Saw Richard. It just showed me something different about life and longing and sadness that I didn't know about yet as a young teenager, but it opened the door to suffering, but in a beautiful way of expressing suffering and sadness and change.
The last time I saw Richard was Detroit in 68, and he told me all romantics meet the same fate someday. Cynical and drunk and boring someone in some dark cafe. You laugh, he said, you think you're immune. Go look at your eyes. You like roses and kisses and pretty men to tell you all those pretty lies, when you're gonna realize they're only pretty lies.
The final track on Joni Mitchell's 1971 fourth album, Blue, The Last Time I Saw Richard. We are on the road to Joni with Bela Fleck.
As time goes by, I keep going back to the production on that record. It was just so cool. All of a sudden, a band would come in, you know, out of nowhere, sounding like they were coming through a scratchy radio. And
I'm drinking sweet champagne, got the headphones up high. Can't numb me out, can't drum me out of my mind. They're playing goodbye, baby, baby, goodbye. Love is blind. Up go the flaps. Down go the wheels.
Another track from Blue, This Flight Tonight. Here's Bela Fleck.
Hope they finally
and the people on that record just playing these beautiful acoustic things. That always stuck with me, that beauty of a small ensemble, but not being afraid of, you know, just doing crazy stuff for one section. The way the pedal steel sounded when it showed up. There's just a bunch of different things on that record that just were so perfect. The guitar playing, Stephen Stills and James Taylor. And the piano playing stuck with me too. It just sounded so perfect. Like they couldn't have come up with a more perfect choice for any note that she played on that record. And the way it interfaced with the vocal taught me, it was my opening understanding of how a singer-songwriter can kind of create simultaneously on voice and an instrument. And it becomes an interlocked situation where you can't imagine either the vocal or the accompaniment being any different. Great composition.
Yeah, and production, which she often doesn't get name-checked for, but she's produced almost all of her records except for that first one, and then I think one or two tracks on the second album.
Oh yeah, she knew what she was doing. She had an inner voice that was loud, has, I should say, and she trusted it, and she trusted it over the noise of people, you know, mansplaining to her how her music should go. And I thought that was pretty incredible too. Has always been inspiring to me when people would tell me, oh, you don't know what you're doing or whatever. I think, well, I'm the one that's, if I don't know, then you sure don't, because I'm the artist, you know. So what happened with our son is we had a moment when he was having an unexpected bleeding situation, and we had to bring him into the hospital and try to figure out what was going on in time to save his life. And it turned out that he didn't have some clotting factors in his blood that he needed in order to stop bleeding. And so we had to hold him down all night against his will while this new blood was going into his body. And in the morning, we were going to find out whether it worked or not, whether he started to clot. So all night we sat with a couple of friends and had to hold him down. He didn't like it, and hoping that it would clot and waiting for the blood to go in. And we listened to Night Ride Home all night, just over and over again. So there's been times like that. And by the way, everything's fine. He's doing great.
Great.
We figured it out and he's in great shape. But it was one of the most terrifying moments as a parent or as a human being. And she was right there with us. And so that became a lot of time. That became the nighttime music for both of the boys.
Like this, like some surrealist invented this 4th of July night at home. Hula girls and caterpillar tractors in the sand, and ukulele men, the fireworks this 4th of July. Overkill, far from the overload. Back to the bar, the band tears down, but I'll hear in the headlines the silver power line. Night ride home.
Before the kids, I would just check in with it every few years. There's certain pieces of music that would just stick with me, and I'd always check into what she was doing. I was so thrilled when she made Night Ride Home, because it was connected to that early Joni that I loved so much and experienced kind of in real time when she was doing it.
Back in 1957, we had to dance a foot apart. And they hawk on us from the sidelines, holding their rulers without a heart. And so with just a touch of our fingers, all we could make our circuitry explode. All we ever wanted was just to come in from the cold.
Night Ride Home is Joni Mitchell's first album in 3 years and her most well-received in 10. It is a spare, intimate portrait of a happily married woman in her 40s, a portrait that some fans have a hard time accepting.
All people wanted to do is hear me suffering, you know. You know, ever since I got married, they couldn't relate to me because I had become civic-minded and, you know, my politics were showing, and they really wanted me back there, single and suffering, you know. You know, sin eater to my generation. And since I am happily married, this poses a problem. So there are some love songs that are fictional, and there are some that are semi-fictional. I never had a long-term relationship before this relationship, but I was kind of sick of that feeling. I knew it was no longer good for me, you know. Like, I mean, even at the beginning of my relationship with my husband, I kept saying to him, I'll be glad when this part's over, you know, like, and it kind of levels out, you know.
Klein and Mitchell also collaborated on a series of photographs taken on a trip back to Joni's native Canada. The photos eventually ended up as the cover art for Night Ride Home.
We took pictures of all the little houses, you know, that we lived in, my parents and I. And Klein, my husband, he's a city boy, he's from East LA. He'd never really spent a lot of time in rural situations in the fields of wheat. It was interesting to him, and I think, and exciting. Anyway, while we were driving, we made terrible time because we'd be jumping out of the car every 5 minutes. We saw an old barn that the spine of it had broken down on a gray day, sitting out in a field of ripe wheat. And we spent 1 hour or so leaping around in the wheat and taking pictures of each other.
That's Joni Mitchell talking about Night Ride Home from a 1991 VH1 special called VH1 to 1. I'm Carmel Holt, and when we come back, Bela Fleck tells us about how Joni's husband, Larry Klein, would lead Bela Fleck to Joni's doorstep as the road to Joni continues.
How's it going, everyone? I'm Malachi Coons. You're listening to Shiro's Radio. Thank you for spending your Saturday with us here on KAXE, where support comes from Empty Bowls, fighting local hunger and building a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 24th at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project. During our Come Home to KAXC Fall Membership Drive next week, our staff are hosting Trivia Nights Thursday, October 24th in both Bemidji and Grand Rapids. Both events start at 6 p.m. at Bemidji Brewing and Clockau Brewing in Grand Rapids. All are welcome. Coming up at 3 o'clock, it is Mixtape with DJ Siege and DJ Dang. Then Eric Otto's in for Americana at 5, and Janet and Christy will be your Green Cheese Trivia hosts tonight from 7 o'clock until 9 p.m. Right now, we're back to Shiro's Radio on member-supported KAXE.
We're on the road to Joni with Bela Fleck, and I'm Carmel Holt. Bela was just telling us about the significance of the 1991 album Night Ride Home, co-produced by Joni Mitchell's husband, Larry Klein. The year that Night Ride Home was released, Sean Colvin was recording her sophomore album, Fat City, produced by Larry Klein. Here's Bela Fleck.
The other fun thing that happened one day is I got a call to play on a Sean Colvin record, And Joni's husband at the time was producing.
Larry Klein, that's right.
Larry Klein, yeah. And so he said, all right, we'll come over to the house and we'll do the session. And it was Joni's house. She had her studio set up right there in the house. And so that's where it was. And I walked in and came in through the kitchen and there was like a table. I was like, oh, this is where Joni's coffee cup is. You know, I can imagine her sitting here smoking a cigarette, and it didn't smell like cigarettes, but just, you know, this is where she dwells. And being so excited to be there and kind of looking around the corners, hoping she was around somewhere, but she wasn't. I never got to meet her.
In Joni Mitchell and Larry Klein's house in 1991. That's Sean Colvin's Tennessee, featuring our guest, Bela Fleck on banjo, and our other guest this week, Bruce Hornsby on piano. The album was produced by Joni Mitchell's husband, Larry Klein. We're on the road to Joni with Bela Fleck. You mentioned discovering Blue before you ever picked up a banjo, and I love this story that you just told about getting invited by Larry Klein. Anything else that you can point to that you could say, my road to Joni led me here?
Well, there's one other thing. I remember making a Christmas album with the Flecktones, my band of many years, and deciding I wanted to do something with River. And so I had this idea, well, maybe I can figure out a way to play the bass notes on the piano and then play the rest of it on the banjo, the high part on the banjo. But I don't know how to play the piano, but I have one. So the only way I could figure out how to do it was to take tape and put it on every key and write the names of the notes on it, of all the bass notes I was going to hit. And then I stuck a brick on the hold pedal so that when I played a bass note, it would ring. And then I could get back to the banjo and play the next part. And so I went through all this trouble and cobbled together this arrangement that involved, you know, punching things in and doing it section by section and doing it, you know, for a whole day trying to play it, and ended up with something, you know, that I was satisfied with, that we put on the record. Nobody has ever noticed it. Nobody has ever said a single word to me about it. Nobody has ever said, oh, that's pretty cool. That must have been hard to do, playing the bass notes and playing the banjo. And it's just one of those thankless things, but that was one of those things. I did it for me, and I was so happy, and I was hearing her voice the whole time I was doing it. I was imagining being her somehow, as impossible as that could be.
Bela Fleck and the Flecktones covering Joni Mitchell's River on the 2008 album Jingle All the Way. I asked Bela Fleck how it's felt witnessing Joni Mitchell's renaissance and return to the stage.
I have to tell you, I was at Newport and nobody told me. I was there on the first day and then I did my stuff, performed and everything and had a wonderful time and then left. And then that next night, I saw that nobody ever told me. Nobody let me know they were rehearsing right in the building next to me. Or, you know, I was right there. I would have stayed in a second to see that moment, and I missed it so close. But I was just so happy. It made me so happy just to see her, because I was worried about her because I heard she had, you know, had some health concerns. And I thought it wasn't looking like she was going to be reemerging. And when she did, it was just like, oh, my God, what a wonderful, wonderful moment. And she seemed to be having so much fun.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Comfortable in her skin and happy. And, you know, I think God bless Brandi Carlile. I'm not a religious person, but God bless Brandi Carlile.
I would have to agree with that. Yeah. I mean, she's really been this ambassador, you know, which has been incredible.
Yeah. Well, she obviously got Joni's trust and it's well placed.
Last question. If you could thank Joni, what would you thank her for?
That's a tough one. I mean, because I think she just is who she is. And I think I would just thank her for being brave enough to be who she is the whole time and grow and change and express. But the gifts of who she is just kind of good fortune. You know, that voice that she has, that sensibility that she has just been a great thing in my whole life to reach back and check in with that every once in a while. And, oh, yeah, it's still great. It's still great. And there's things worth fighting for and worth working hard at. But a lot of it is really just you are what you are. You get what you get, and how to best use that talent or that whatever attributes you have as a human being, how to own them and trust yourself. A lot of sort of profound stuff. So I would say thank you for being you and sticking to your guns and showing us what a whole life of idealism in music can be and art in music can be.
I couldn't have said it better. That's beautiful. Thank you, Bela. If you were to take us out with a Joni pick, what would you feel like listening to?
Car in the Hill. Gosh, I love that so much. That orchestration is so fantastic. And I can hear her. I know she had help. But gosh, you can hear her making all these incredible choices and how beautiful it is. That was also very inspiring to me, by the way she used the orchestra on that record, the idea that it could come and go like that and just be brought in for when it's needed. I love that one. There's so many songs on that record I love, but that's a great one.
I've been sitting up waiting for my sugar to show. I've been listening to the sirens and the radio. He said he'd be over 3 hours ago. I've been waiting for his car on the He makes friends easy, he's not like me. I watch for judgment anxiously. Now where in the city can that boy be? Waiting for a car. Climbing, climbing, climbing the hill.
From Joni Mitchell's Court and Spark album, Car on a Hill, as we take Bela Flex Road to Joni. So literally right before I got on the line with you, I was talking to Bruce Hornsby.
Oh,
and
nice.
He was talking about getting kind of Joni adjacent by working with Larry Klein on Sean mm-hmm. Colvin records. I mean, so cool that came up twice back to back.
Well, I'm glad you talked to Bruce. I can hear that influence in him. We have never talked about it. Our Joni love, but we've talked a lot about one of our other big favorites that we have talked a lot about is Randy Newman.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, another iconoclast with the nerve to be himself.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, someday I'm going to have to make this official and get you and Bruce together to do a Joni guest DJ set. It'd be amazing.
All right.
Thanks,
Bela. Thanks a lot. It was fun.
Many thanks once again to Bela Fleck for being with us on The Road to Joni. Before we wrap up this week, be sure to tag us at The Road to Joni or at Carmel Holt with your favorite moments from Joni Mitchell's Two Nights at the Hollywood Bowl, and I hope to see you there. Thanks as always for being with us. I'm Carmel Holt. Today's episode is also available as a podcast distributed by Talkhouse and available everywhere. Subscribe and download to The Road to Joni so you never miss an episode. Also, join us on Instagram and X at The Road to Joni and at Shiro's Radio, and follow along as we take Shiro's on the road, stopping along the way at our public radio affiliates. Our road trip is super powered by Rivian with audio equipment provided by Rode. The Road to Joni is a Shiro's production created, edited, and produced by me. Our series audio engineer and production consultant is Kelly Drake. We get production assistance from Keelan Castelline. Our theme music is by Lucius and remixed by Meg Tui. The Road to Joni Shiro's Tour is executive produced by Stacey Condi and Ariella Levitan and by our Shiro and creative consultant, Julie Muncie. Shiro's is an independent, woman and queer-led production that relies on support from listeners just like you. Donate online at shirosradio.com/road to Joni. And thank you. Next on The Road to Joni.
I don't even remember what the decision behind getting the Joni tattoo was, other than just like, maybe it's, you know, an inspiring place to have the tattoo on my right hand, my strumming hand. It just felt like if I'm going to get a tattoo of a musician, it'll probably be that. But people often think this is Cher. They're like, is that Cher? Like, no. But respect. Love Cher, too.
At KAXE, we keep it local.
then I realized how important my art was to me, how it calms me. It takes all my cares and my woes away.